This is Johnny Garrett, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. A decade in beer can feel like a lifetime. As Tottenham's Redemption Brewing Co. approached their 10th birthday, looking back must be dizzying. Redemption was one of London's first craft brewers, but is now just one of over 100. Founder Andy Moffat has grown his business slowly and organically with a focus on sessionable cask ale, despite a consumer shift to the hop-focused, high-ABV American styles brewed by those who came in his wake. Here, Redemption went from sign of the future to link to the past, and while cask ale went into volume decline, keg-focused neighbours like Beavertown and Camden grew to five or six times Redemption's size and then sold to international conglomerates. Most companies would have ripped up their business plans, but Redemption responded to it all with quiet dignity and the belief that cask ale is unique and worth persevering with. When you try a fresh Trinity or Hotspur, you see where that confidence comes from, but even so, the brewery is changing. Moffat followed up a recent expansion with a £300,000 crowdfunding campaign to finance further development and forays into keg and even cans. We sit down in the half-finished tap room to reminisce about London before the beer revolution, the challenges of brewing session beer, and how cask is perhaps the only constant in this new, ever-changing British beer world. This is Andy Moffat, founder of Redemption Brewing Co. Listen in. I guess the place I'd want to start, and probably lots of people, because we have lots of an audience in America and around the world, is introducing yourself and the early story of how Redemption came about, and we'll tell the story of the brewery as we go.
So I'm Andy Moffat from Redemption Brewing, and we started building the brewery back in 2009. I'd kind of been struck by how throughout the rest of the UK, there were so many, I guess what the term was then was microbreweries, if you like, small local breweries. And yet in London, this hadn't really been the case. In fact, it was almost quite the opposite. Some breweries had been leaving London. And at the point when we were considering starting a brewery, there was Fuller's and Meantime and Twickenham. And that was pretty much it. And then kind of after we decided, I probably spent about a year trying to convince myself it's a bad idea, because if there were so few breweries in London, there was probably a good reason for it. And the more I kind of researched it, the more I looked into it, the more I thought, well, maybe this could work. And at that time, of course, we were just heading into the kind of financial crisis as well. So there were potential issues in the economy. And there were also, there was a lot of negative press about pubs as well. Pubs were closing a lot. And so kind of the typical comment to me is, why would you want to start a brewery in this environment where pubs are closing and, you know, we're kind of heading into a recession?
To me, it sounds like there were lots of reasons not to open a brewery in London, but you managed to persuade yourself it was a good idea. So what were the good ideas about being in London?
I think what we started to see was people like Brewdog and Thornbridge. So Thornbridge were quite in their infancy, and Brewdog had really just started to become established, but were still doing cask back then, and were still in their much smaller unit. And so you started to see a lot more recognition of beer. You started to see beer events happening, people talking about beer, more beer blogs starting, and people really being a lot more interested in beer. And also it was starting to attract a different kind of group as well. There were a lot more younger people getting interested in beer and the different styles that really we hadn't seen for a while. They were suddenly becoming much more accessible. So we kind of made the decision, right, okay, we'll go ahead with this. And very quickly, Sandbrook's had opened, and then Brodie's had started brewing as well. And then Colonel just started just before us, and suddenly there were a few more breweries in London. And by the time we started, you know, there was about five, six, seven of us brewing in London. And that, when you see other people doing it as well, it kind of reaffirms maybe, okay, this probably isn't a crazy idea.
So most breweries that you'll interview in London, or most brewers will, if you ask them where did the inspiration come, where did the idea come from, most of them will point to Evan.
Yes, yeah.
You predate Evan of Colonel. So was it Meantime, or was it Sandbrook's, or your own home brewing?
For me, really, it was probably looking at what breweries outside of London were doing. So I remember quite early on, there was this event at the Islington Design Centre on Opera Street. And it was one of the first of these beer events where you go in, you'd pay a ticket price, and you get to go in and see all these breweries and see all these brewers and try all these different beers. And amongst the brewers that were there were Brewdog at Thornbridge. And at Thornbridge, I kind of met Kelly Ryan, for example. And there were some people involved in the industry back then that were really incredible people to learn from, and they had great ideas and they were exciting. And so I think a lot of where my inspiration came from was actually reading about people like Thornbridge starting, you know, the early days of Brewdog, people like Hawkshead Brewery in the Lake District, a lot of these other breweries who really had probably been either some going for a little bit of time, others still quite new, but were starting to do things quite differently, maybe brand their beers quite differently as well, and starting to attract a different group of drinkers and a different demographic to beer. Hmm.
So a lot of the people you're mentioning are perhaps now known for keg beer.
Yes.
And yet you went for cask, sort of followed more the Fuller's and to some extent, I guess, Thornbridge mould. Why did you go for cask in a town dominated by Young's and by Fuller's?
I think certainly in the early days, the only route to market, in a way, was cask. And I mean, Camden kind of maybe quickly changed that, in a way, but Camden Town Brewery. But early on, you know, you wouldn't even think that you'd be able to get on a keg handle in a pub. We knew when we started that we could brew good beer. Our concern was, will we be able to sell it? And cask was the traditional independent free pub, where there was rotating hand pumps, for example. I mean, we quickly found there were places back then at the Wenlock Arms, the old fountain, a lot of what were traditional cask houses, if you like, where a lot of the camera members would go that would want to try something different. And so cask was very much the means, the route into market. And really, there wasn't a lot of keg going on back then at all. I mean, even Colonel, when they started, were mainly doing bottles. So really, it wasn't until probably Camden came along that they started really kind of focusing on keg, and you started seeing a lot more keg going into pubs in London where it had previously been dominated by the larger macro brewers. And even back then, Camden Town were doing cask, for example. So
yeah, the first beer was in a City Green, wasn't it? Pale ale on cask, yeah.
So it was a very different market. I can understand nowadays when some new breweries start, actually they just start with keg. But back then, I think for someone like us, a fairly small brewery, without maybe some of the benefits of some of the kind of the brand marketing expertise that kind of Camden had behind them, it would have been very difficult, I think, for someone like us to really make much of a mark in the keg market. It was a lot easier to start in cask and develop a reputation there and get into a number of the pubs that were already quite active in looking for new breweries in the cask market.
And did you get much support from other London brewers when you opened? I know there was the London Brewers Association, which to me now seems like the Stonecutters from The Simpsons, because everyone that was part of it is now incredibly famous in the beer world and were clearly going, well, people didn't realise they were going on to big things, apart from perhaps the guys from Fuller's. But what was the purpose behind London Brewers Association?
So London Brewers Alliance.
It was
Phil Lowry, when he, there used to be a great brewery, bar, restaurant called Brew Wharf down by London Bridge in Borough Market. And he came up with the idea to try and get some of the people, because there now were a few people in London brewing beer, to get us all together and kind of help each other out. And that's where I met Evan from Colonel. And, you know, at that first meeting, John Keeling, formerly of Fuller's, and Derek Prentice, formerly of Fuller's Brewery, both came down as well. So we started to see, okay, you know, this could be quite good. We've got some senior brewers who are kind of, you know, famous with massive reputations, keen to get involved in this. And that was quite useful. I mean, we'd always, when we started quite early on, we'd always begged, borrowed, and stolen from Brodie's, who were up the road at that time in Leyton. So there are always these kind of relationships going on when there's so few of you, and I think it's characterized the brewing industry, not just in London, but probably in a number of other regions as well, where everyone's quite helpful and wants to get on, and we want to grow our share, if you like, as a group of independents. And really, I think the London Brewers Alliance just grew from there as more breweries came in, people got involved, they saw it was a good opportunity to learn from other people, to share experiences. And one of the things now is that everyone's so busy that actually, I probably see people less now than I used to in those early days. I mean, quite early on, for example, when we first started, Kernel had a much smaller plant than us. Ours was quite old, and we had surplus tanks when we bought them, so we sold a couple of the smaller tanks to Kernel. And likewise, we used to do a collaboration because they were struggling with their capacity. They would come up and we'd brew a beer, we would cask half of it, and then they would come up and bottle half of it as well. So there were some really kind of good, fun kind of times back then.
And what did you talk about in those meetings? I mean, I'm intrigued what John Keeling, with his giant ancient brew house, could say to somebody who's, twice the size of a home brewer at that point, I guess.
I think it was about kind of sharing experiences and enthusiasm. So everyone was just interested in good beer and a respect for each other's beer and each other's style of beer as well. So, all the brewers in that room, kind of respected Fuller's, for example, and respected the likes of John and Derek. And if you've probably met Derek before as well. Mm-hmm. The enthusiasm he's got for someone who's been in the industry so long, it's just such an inspiration, really. And he's so keen on developing younger people and talent and educating people. And so really, I think they were keen on just helping the standard of beer in London just get better and better and better, because they could see that, I guess, some people could, that the London brand was maybe something that could be quite important. And I think it probably has been. London breweries have benefited from this historic tradition of brewing in London. And I think it's allowed breweries in London maybe to kind of always be more likely than not above the radar relative to other parts of the country.
Mm. And so if we fast forward a couple of years, around 2010 to maybe 2013 is when all the breweries started opening. So you had Camden open.
Camden were not long after us, to be fair. They were back in about June, July 2010. So they were there quite early on as well. But they were obviously a different level in terms of the investment that they were putting into it.
Yeah. So they sort of opened the door and, like you say, maybe opened the door to keg beer.
Yes. Yeah.
And from there, that's where the real revolution sort of kicked off, I think. And then you had people like Beavertown and Four Pure founding. What was it like to be somebody who had put their stall on cask to see the keg breweries sort of take off?
I think we've probably been a little bit conservative almost, in that we've kind of always felt quite comfortable in what we've done. We've had the resources for cask. Our setup has been geared towards cask, our assets in terms of, we all have a lot of casks that we own, for example, and that's kind of a valuable asset, and you don't just want to kind of not make the most of those. And I think the style of our beers has probably generally been quite well suited to cask as well. Our customer base is kind of known us as cask, and it's what we've been good at. And I think there is an aspect to kind of recognizing where your strengths lie as well. So, we don't do any barrel aging for that, for example. Now, could we barrel age? I'm sure we could. Would we add anything to what's being done out there? I'm not quite sure that we would add anything kind of new or anything different. So I think sometimes if you want to be a really kind of good business as well and focus on what you do really well, for us that has been very much cask, and we've wanted to try and ensure that that's where our strength lies. Now we're doing a little bit more keg now, and we recognize that we probably need to do a little bit more keg because the market has certainly diversified a bit more. But one of the interesting things is we've already had people talk about cask being kind of always sold very cheap and the lacking a kind of premium price point. We've always found we've managed to get a good price for our cask because we've focused on quality and because we've, I think, had a good reputation for cask. And it's an area that we think that we can, do business very well in. But I think as the keg market gets increasingly competitive, you're starting to see some of those same pressures, I guess, it affected casks starting to come into the keg market.
Seeing the race to the bottom in the pricing and all that kind of stuff just starting to begin.
I think it's already, yeah, there has been some of that. And the other thing about keg is I think as a product category, it is more brand and more marketing heavy as well. And you see the breweries that have done very well, you know, they have invested a lot more in marketing and branding. And I think as a smaller brewery as well, you sometimes need to recognize where you can compete as well. And, you know, we know we can't compete with some of the marketing budgets or some of the expertise some of the other breweries have. And so, you know, when we do keg, we'll have to do it slightly different. We won't be able to necessarily compete in terms of the venues we're going into, in terms of the styles of beer. We'll need to kind of do it our way, if you like, and accept that there are bigger breweries out there on the craft side who, you know, are now investing in centrifuges and lots of really expensive equipment. The other aspect of keg is there is more technology that can be utilized in keg. Cask is much more basic in terms of the technology. And in that sense, the bigger, better resourced craft breweries can do a lot more with keg, like, you know, buying a centrifuge, for example. These things are very expensive. And so they can do a lot more with that, and it can help them to, you know, really raise the quality significantly.
And what's it been like to see some of those breweries that have invested heavily in their brew house technology, focused on keg, and now they're coming in and quote, saving cask?
Yeah.
How does that feel when you're like, well, I've been doing this for like nearly a decade, doing very well, getting my margins, creating delicious beer. I'm not sure it needs saving.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be a good cask market, and I think it's always great to see, you know, breweries come in and do cask. A lot of breweries might have started with cask and then they've maybe kind of moved away towards keg, and to see them coming back to do it, even if it's just in small amounts, I think is still great, because it maybe gives people exposure to cask who otherwise wouldn't have had exposure to cask. Because I think, again, beer, there's a trend element in beer just now. It has become quite fashionable. And I think people that are maybe drinking particular styles or particular brands, particular breweries, you know, whatever that brewery produces, they're going to maybe be more willing to give it a try, as opposed to maybe a more traditional brewery, for example. And if they try something, you know, that the likes of a Cloudwater does in cask and they like it, next time they're in the pub and they see a cask beer, they might think, actually, you know, I really like the cask ale that I had from Cloudwater, so I'm more willing to try, you know, whether it's someone like Redemption, whether it's someone like Acorn Brewery in Barnsley, or Hawkshead Brewery, or whoever. I think it's probably good for the market.
And do you think there's something that cask brewers can do to try to capitalize on that? Obviously, cask has a reputation for being fairly poorly branded. Occasionally, one of the isms has been involved on the pump clip, and it alienates people. Is there something that the Redemption are going to do, or that other brewers could do to go, well, hey, it's on trend at the moment, even if at the bottom of the market it's incredibly hard? What can we do to capitalize?
I think that trying to come up with maybe better branding, better marketing, always focusing on quality, and also the aspect of cask, that it is quite often a very local product as well, and selling that local provenance. I mean, I think one of the reasons London became very popular in brewing was partly because that kind of moved towards localism. And I kind of felt when we started that people were starting to maybe move away a bit from organic towards localism, and actually people wanted to support their local producers, whether that was food or drink. And I think as cask ale producers, one of the things that we can always do is really highlight the relevance of that being quite a local product, as it often is with cask. Branding, I think, obviously appealing to as diverse a group of people as possible, avoiding any kind of sexist elements, and trying to be much more clean and modern with your design. And then the style of the beers as well. Trying to do beers that there's certain beer styles that won't work that great in cask. I think you have to accept that. But trying to put beers together that are going to be fairly modern in style, but still have that drinkability, sessionability, which cask drinkers really, really like. Mm. And that's not always easy to get, but we've tried to achieve that with beers like Trinity, for example. And then, you know, our Big Chief, our IPA, that's quite you know, it's quite a sessionable IPA as well. It's got the hop character, but you're not going to get the same hop character coming out of a cask ale as you are coming out of a keg beer, for example.
Yeah, it doesn't leap out the glass in the same way.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's got to be more subtle, and it's got to be... And then I think people appreciate that as well.
So, yeah, talking about your beers for a bit, you actually... You know, perhaps the way that you would differentiate yourself from the cask breweries that were there at the start was use of not just American or Kiwi hops, but like Casbec and... Yeah. Pretty unusual hops that even now, you know, lots of people probably don't know that Casbec is even a hop.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that a deliberate choice you made to stand out from, say, Fuller's, like those recipes with a slightly modern or unusual twist?
Yes, I think it was trying to find find hops that were a little bit different. And actually, we've kind of been influenced by some of the breweries up north. So, for example, Acorn Brewery do some cracking beers, and they'd always use some Slovenian and Polish hops in some of their beers, which I always really liked. And when we were looking at doing more of a kind of a blonde ale, again, quite often speaking to your hop merchant, you get a feel for stuff that's new. And this was a new hop back then that was coming through the Czech government's hop development program. And so, you know, on the hop merchant's advice, we thought we'd give it a try, and it worked really well. It was a lovely hop. So I think a kind of conscious effort of trying to find things that are just a little bit different but will still work well in the style of beers that we're doing. And again, being influenced and inspired by other breweries, and then, you know, speaking to other people within the industry, whether it's brewers or our suppliers as well, and taking advantage of their experience and what they see going on in the wider industry.
And, I mean, everyone talks about hops when they talk about beer because obviously IPA is so popular. But is there a lot to be said for the sourcing of the malts as well, particularly when it comes to cask beer, which might be more malt heavy or certainly will feel more malt heavy in the mouth because it's less effervescent? Do you give the same care to your malt bills as you do to your hop regimes?
Yes, and particularly for cask ale, because one of the important things, I guess, for cask is that it's still... You still quite often want to deliver a fairly clear product in cask. So clarity continues to be more important in cask, for example, than it is in keg. And one of the things you need to kind of be conscious of in terms of malt, and this is something that will change from year to year, is depending on the malt crop, that can have a big impact on your ability to get clear beer and your ability to get extract. And of course, malt is really the key quite often to brewing because you need to understand all these different aspects in terms of color of the beer, so the different characteristics of the malt. You need to understand the malt changing from season to season and the impact that's going to have on your extract. Again, the nitrogen levels and whether that's also going to have both an impact on your extract but also an impact on your clarity and if there's anything you may need to do in order to ensure that you can deliver that product into the pub, into the drinker's glass as they would expect it. You know, we can't really get away with hazy beer on our, you know, the way we are probably because we've become associated with having clear beer. So we do need to kind of, you know, keep an eye on the malt characteristics. If the malt changes from season to season, and that can be really important. And we use, quite a few different colored malts. So we use most of it's pale, pale ale malt, obviously, but we do use kind of Crystal, Munich, brown malt, some low-colored chocolate malt, some regular chocolate malt, so a range of different malts, and we need to keep an eye on the characteristics and the specifications of that.
And we've touched on a prickly topic. I wrote an article for Gibby Hunting about it recently in my attempt to work out what's wrong with the cask market and how to fix it. I talked a lot about quality.
Yeah, yeah.
What's it like to be a brewer who you work very hard, you look very carefully into, you know, the nitrogen levels of your malt, and then it's served wrong? You know, keg brewers have that issue to some extent if it's you know, cooked or oxidized or something like that. But with a cask beer, it's so much more delicate. Is that a huge issue for Redemption?
We're fortunate that we have a real good customer base of pubs who, you know, many of them do an excellent job looking after the beer. Obviously, it's frustrating if you find that your beer's not necessarily being served in the best way, if it's being kept on a little bit too long, if it's not being given enough time to rest. I think it's something that's kind of always been a factor in the industry. The thing that we need to do is, first of all, make sure that when the beer leaves our brewery, it's in the best possible state that it can be. And that starts from, you know, simple things like making sure we clean the casks well, for example, making sure that the beer is brewed technically well too. We want to make it as easy as possible for the landlords to manage that beer. And on the whole, I think, it's not, cask beer isn't the most difficult thing in the world to look after. I think what it requires, as with most things in life where it takes a little bit of effort, it's mainly a bit of diligence and a little bit of care. And those two things, I think, can actually make a big difference, you know? So, whether you're an incredibly knowledgeable person or whether you're fairly new to cask ale, I think as long as you kind of have those two aspects of diligence and kind of love and care and attention for your product, really, you know, provided the brewery's done their bit, you should be able to serve beer in a good state. I guess there's issues sometimes in terms of temperature control in some of the pubs, particularly in London during the summer, where you know maybe the coolers aren't necessarily rated for the summer temperature. They're rated more for kind of temperatures during the colder times of the year.
Well, sometimes they forget to switch them on.
Oh, yeah. Or they break or they don't get maintained. Yeah. So those are kind of aspects, I guess, which sometimes, and pubs maybe having a challenging time economically, these aspects of maintenance can sometimes be pushed to the side. And so when a problem does happen, you know, it can take a bit longer.
You put it off until your bank balance is healthier and then, yeah. Is there anything that the industry or industry bodies like Camra or journalists or brewers or pubs could do to help raise the bar in terms of quality across the board? Because I honestly feel, particularly in London, it's a bit of a lottery. So I always say never buy a cask beer until you've had a sample of it.
Yeah.
Is there anything that can be done?
I think encouraging samples is a great way for people to give confidence in the cask that they have. We spoke about the branding, so that's obviously, aside from the quality. Education, I think, is useful if breweries can educate their customers.
So you think it's the brewer that's responsible?
I think if breweries can do more, I think if breweries are going to give a good standard of service to the pubs and they can say, right, you know, putting, for example, basic information in the cask label, you know, this beer should be stored at this temperature and should be left for this amount of time to settle, are fairly basic things that you can provide on the label just to give some basic information to a publican. And I think probably the best thing is if customers complain when they do get a bad pint, and for pubs to then take that into consideration and base their ordering on kind of the beers that work well for them, that are consistent. There is maybe in the cask beer world quite often a view that more choice is better, and that's not to say that more choice is not good, but sometimes in a pub there's no point in having 10 cask ales on where maybe really the throughput of the pub would only justify 3. You'd be much better having 3 or 4 really well looked after good beers that are going to sell very quickly, you know, as opposed to having 10 different beers on. I think, you know, understand that sometimes it's not all about how many different styles of cask beer you can have on. It's more about making sure the ones you do have are kept in prime condition. Mm-hmm. And, you know, don't be afraid to say, actually, we're only going to have 3 casks on. But you know what? They're going to be 3 really, really good cask beers. And actually, people are going to come in and they're going to really enjoy drinking those. And they're going to be kept at top quality. And we'll get through them really quickly. I think there is always a kind of pubs can be very easily tempted to try and put more on so that they can attract a wider audience. And in the long run, I think that can sometimes work against a pub.
Yeah, and I think it applies for people selling keg as well.
Yes, yeah.
And also for breweries brewing endless seasonal beers.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's great to nail your core range.
And
That means a customer's going to rely on you for a good beer and know that it's going to come.
Yes, yeah.
GBH is underwritten in part by Brewery Omegang out of Cooperstown, New York, a 20-year-old pioneer of Belgian brewing in America. We're publishing a series of stories exploring the state of Belgian beer called Message in a Bottle, highlighting the influence of the Belgian brewing philosophy on the contemporary American scene. GBH is also underwritten in part by New Belgium Brewing, an employee-owned craft brewery with the oldest continuous sour culture in America. with New Belgium, we're bringing you a new series of stories called Into the Wild. Wild and sour ale in America is a story all its own, and we're still in those early foundational chapters. These are stories about how those beers challenge and inspire the brewers and drinkers who seek them out. GBH is also underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with on a new series called Mother of Invention. Stories devoted to illuminating innovation in the brewing world that impacts the beer in your hand in unexpected ways. Guinness just officially opened their first purpose-built brewery in the U.S. just outside of Baltimore, Maryland, where they have a 2- and 10-barrel brewing system that makes a wide spectrum of contemporary styles served in the taproom only, and a 100-hectoliter system where they're scaling up some of their latest recipes for national distribution in the U.S., like the recently reinvented Blonde Ale and an American-style IPA. You should definitely visit, have a seat in their epic beer garden, and tour the historic distillery site, the first legal distillery after Prohibition in Maryland, right off historic Route 1. And of course, we're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pier Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., The 5 Points Brewing Company, London Fields Brewery, Verdant Brewing Company, and Boundary Brewing in Belfast. In the US, we have the Mitten Bar in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, Hops and Grain in Texas, Common House Ale Works in South Carolina, Yocusta Brewing in North Carolina, National Craft Retailer, Craft Beer Cellar, and Daredevil Brewing in Indianapolis. And then there's Devil's Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, and Stone and Wood Brewing Company along the far eastern shore of Australia, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew.
So how do you, when you look at the cask market now, compared to how it was when you started, is it healthier, or all these doomsayers exaggerating for headlines?
I think because there's a lot more competition now in cask and in brewing in general. I mean, when we first started, we would get a call from a pub saying, "Oh, I hear you're a new brewery. Can you drop us some beer?" And then one of the other pubs would phone, "Oh, I saw some of your beer on at the Wenlock Arms. Can you drop some over to us?" And people wouldn't even ask the price, for example. It's a very different industry now. I think, in one sense, the market is in better health because there is wider acceptance of smaller breweries, I think. So, when we started, and I don't know if it's still the case now, but certainly when we started, the kind of dominant beer in a pub in London wasn't London Pride, it was probably Doombar. And actually now, pubs that previously that weren't stocking any London beers are only stocking London beers now, whether that be cask or keg. So the pub landscape has changed massively. I mean, I think people quite often take for granted the pub landscape in London just now. When we first started, there was no Euston Tap. There was no Craft Beer Co. I think that there was Cask in Pimlico. And a lot of the pubs that we see today that are stocking kind of craft beer and indeed London beers, weren't stocking those beers back then either. So the pub landscape has changed dramatically. And in that sense, I think it's a healthier marketplace now. One of the maybe issues is that there's a lot more breweries, and so there's a lot more competition to get into pubs now. And that is, of course, what can push pricing down. And so you want to try and maintain that kind of price premium that you hold. But at the same time, you want to increase your volumes and grow as a business, and it can be difficult to balance that off.
Yeah, so what do you say when you get approached by a good pub that would look after the beer and they turn their nose up at your pricing? Are your sales guys going, "Well, these are the reasons, it's because of the quality of the beer"? But that's getting hard to say, because quality is on the whole going up in both keg and cask. So how do you get around that?
Well, we found that actually a lot of the really good pubs they know the market really well, they know the pricing really well. And our pricing we've never been the cheapest, but we've never been the most expensive. And I remember one of the best comments I got was from one of the top end craft beer pubs in London. And he said, "Think about you guys as your great value." And I think by what he meant there is actually, we deliver a really good product at a good, fair price. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where kind of redemption lies. I think it's about, it's important as any business to get that pricing right. You have to get a good enough price to support your own business, support your own growth. At the same time, you have to recognize that everyone in the chain needs to ideally be able to make money on that, and that you have to deliver a pint to a customer at a fair price that they're prepared to pay as well. And I think, you know, in terms of when you're putting a beer together, when you're putting a recipe together, you know, you kind of need to bear that in mind as well. And you need to try and manage your business well and look for those areas, you know, where you can make cost savings, like, you know, like your chemicals, for example, or try and order more so you can get cheaper costs ordering in bulk. Finding those areas where there might be inefficiencies so that you can try and get those savings to allow you to invest more in your business. So we've never really had that issue in terms of people saying we're too expensive. Not from the good pubs anyway. The good pubs kind of know pricing, and quite often...
And hopefully they'll balance it across their range. If they've got five cask ales, they'll have one that's going to cost you £4.50 and one that's going to cost you £3.30.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And you know, obviously Trinity being a lower ABV beer quite often is a lower price because there's much less duty on it. And pubs will quite often, you know, have that at a really good price point, whereas they'll have a 6-7% cask, if you like, that's obviously going to be a more specialist beer at a much higher price. And I think that's the key to a good pub, is kind of understanding that and knowing kind of those breweries, again, that are going to deliver consistent quality beer, the right style of beer at the right price as well. You know, there's plenty of breweries selling really cheap beer that, you know, that aren't going to get into places like the, you know, the Euston Tap or Craft Beer Co. Likewise, there's some place that's selling really expensive beer that might not get into some of those pubs either, because, you know, those businesses also recognize where they can charge a premium, and they need to kind of make their decision based on that kind of quality and price trade-off.
So you touched on ABV briefly there, and I think it's something that the UK's very famous for, this ability of our breweries to brew what in America would be extremely low strength beer, and here is regarded as session between like 3.5 and 4.5 maybe. But we also watched, because so many of the breweries that founded around when you did were American influenced.
Yes, yeah.
They ramped up their ABVs, and now you're seeing them all come back, and you're just sat here sort of waving, going, "Hey guys, thanks for rejoining." Were you ever tempted to produce bigger beer? Like your biggest is Big Chief, I presume.
Our biggest core is Big Chief. We do, if we do specials, sometimes we'll kind of normally try to get them up to about 6%. We did our Victorian Mild collaboration with Colonel, for example, which we did years ago, and then we reintroduced last year as a special, and that's 6%. And some of the other ones we've done have been kind of round about that 6% if it's a kind of an IPA style beer. But generally, in terms of our core beers, Big Chief is our highest ABV at 5.5.
And then the rest of your range, like Trinity and Hopspur, are way, way down.
Yep, yep.
Did you ever see a point where those sales dipped as a result, or have you seen them spike as interest has come back round?
No, it's always been fairly stable, I think. Partly, I mean, Trinity's always done quite well because it's been considered a good low ABV beer in its category, and it works really well, particularly in some pubs. I think it's, again, one of the reasons we've stayed with those styles of ABV is because we've been cask-focused. You know, that cask ale needs to sell in about 3 days. And if your ABV is going to be too high, that's going to make it a lot more difficult for that beer to shift. So you need to get the right kind of balance for the people that are going to go in and going to have a session, hopefully, on your beer, so that cask will get turned over as quickly as possible. So that's probably influenced us quite a bit on ABVs. You know, we wouldn't be against doing higher ABV beers, but again, I think it comes down to what do we think we're good at doing, where do we think our strengths lie, and in what is becoming a more congested market, sometimes focusing on your strengths can be a good thing. In the long run, you might miss out on some of the opportunities to do something a little bit kind of special that can command a big price premium. But I've always been really keen that, you know, we have a good reputation, and, you know, you do something different, and if you don't do it well, you don't really want to hurt the reputation that you've got for doing what you do really well. I think over time we'll start to maybe try and do some more interesting stuff, but I think we're still making sure what we do well just now, and that sessionable cask market is still good to us. We're going to launch a core keg product next year, and that will come in kind of in the low 4% levels. So again, probably for that product, again, as you said, Johnny, that's where the market's come back to now. A lot of kind of, you know, fairly low ABV pale beers, which are very popular, and that's partly, I guess, the way the market's going. People are maybe drinking better, drinking less, but they're also kind of, you know, conscious of the ABVs that they're drinking. And maybe it allows the price point of those beers to also come in at a level where drinkers are prepared to pay.
And to pay for it in a pub rather than
yes, at home.
See the discount of drinking at home, which yes. I think is hugely important to the survival of the pub. And one of the unique things that a pub has over drinking at home, which is its main competitor, is cask, because yeah. you've got to be really into cask if you're going to be pouring your own firkins.
Yeah.
So you mentioned a product that you're releasing next year. There's some big plans coming for the brewery. You've just done a successful crowdfunder. Yeah. And we're sat in and next to what feels like will be a beautiful tap room,
yeah.
but you're kind of sat there waiting and primed.
Yes, yeah.
What made you go for crowdfunding, and what are you hoping to get out of it?
I think we'd seen so many other breweries do it and do it well and get a range of investors, so a kind of an army of ambassadors behind their brand, if you like. And we thought that could be something quite useful. Some of those people have some skills as well that they can kind of give to us too. So one of the reasons was really just to get a lot of people, you know, kind of who have always been quite keen in Redemption, you know, involved, invested in the brand, if you like. So that was one of the main reasons for going down that route. And we have that now. We have kind of 500 shareholders who are, you know, interested in what we're doing, who will want to buy our beers, who will want to tell people about our beers, who will be enthusiastic about our beer. So I think that's a really good, positive thing for the business. And like I said, we've seen so many others do it that really, again, in a competitive marketplace, you probably need to think about doing that, because the other aspect is, well, you can go and, you know, there's obviously two general ways you can raise funds, if you like, without selling out to someone. You can do a crowdfunding campaign and get investors in, or you can do you can go in and get debt finance from a bank or wherever. And actually, the good thing about crowdfunding is, you know, the with debt finance you have the interest payments regularly, so that again has an impact on your cash flow. Whereas with crowdfunding, you know, you make the payments to investors as the profits start to come in, so you're kind of sharing the risk of the business, and you're sharing the profits as opposed to having those fixed interest payments every month.
Yeah, it's not something that I think all drinkers appreciate, which the cash flow in both breweries and pubs yeah. is incredibly difficult to yes. manage. And if you can borrow by just getting a lump sum and not paying interest, that's a much easier way to manage your finances.
Yes,
than, yeah. So how much did you aim to raise?
So 400,000, but we were aiming 300 and we raised 400,000.
Where is that money going to be spent in the brewery?
So we're going to get two. So at the moment, our tanks are all dish-bottomed, which is ideal for cask. We're going to get a couple of cylindrical conical FVs now, which will be much more practical for doing a keg product. So that's where some of the investment's going to go in, some carbonation equipment. We're doing a lot more marketing as well. So we're hiring. We've never really had.
So you are trying to compete now with, well, maybe not with Camden Town anymore, but
yeah, we need to up our marketing game. I think it's been a weakness of ours from day one, really, where, you know, it's always been about kind of, you know, investing, you know, money in a good floor, a good cold room, you know, good equipment, and probably marketing branding has suffered. I think in this environment now, this business environment, you need to be much better with your marketing and branding. So we're spending some money on that. And also, we've never really had much of a kind of a sales function. So we're really focusing on growing our sales function now. And that's going to be something I think that will be very helpful to us. Being quite early on, we've always had a lot of core business, which has been, you know, that we've not had to do a lot of kind of heavy selling to, if you like. But I think now, you know, you look at what a lot of other breweries are doing. They're investing in sales teams, marketing functions. That's something we've not done a great deal of. So we need to do a little bit more of that, so we can just make sure that, you know, we're maybe less under the radar all the time. I don't mind being a bit under the radar, but we probably need to just be a bit more proactive in our sales and marketing.
Occasionally, there should be a blip on the radar. So we, like I said, we're sat in what will be a tap room, which I presume you're hoping might be utilised a lot more once Tottenham's
yes.
God, it's going together, quite literally. So Tottenham's going through a huge regeneration project, which is, I guess, to some extent stemmed from the regeneration of Tottenham Hotspur's stadium.
Yes, and post-riots as well.
Right.
Because before the riots happened, we were here on this estate before the riots. We used to be in a smaller unit in this estate, and then, you know, 2-3 years ago, we moved into this larger unit. And again, just going back, when we first came to Tottenham, half of the units in this estate were empty. Now, again, it was, early days of the financial crisis and the recession. Now the estate is absolutely full. And of course, when we first came here, you know, there were no breweries in Tottenham. And in fact, we hardly sold any beer in Tottenham. There weren't many pubs that were selling kind of, you know, beer from smaller breweries. Mm. And that's changed significantly as well.
So you mentioned the riots. That involved some regeneration because they were violent and there were buildings burned down and stuff like that. What was that like being around at that time? Did you feel any effects?
Well, we were away that weekend, funnily enough, and we'd kind of met friends down on the coast, and we kind of got up in the morning and the news was on, and just looking at this, someone said, "That's Tottenham." I was like, "All right, okay." And at the time we thought, well, it's probably not going to, you know, we're in the industrial part of Tottenham, so we're probably not necessarily going to get much kind of trouble down our end. But of course it was, you know, terrible for the area. But I think what it actually did is it actually encouraged people to look at the area, look at investment in Tottenham, and it encouraged a real kind of increase in investment and resources from both local government and central government. And so, you know, Tottenham is changing, and there's good things and bad things about regeneration. But there's certainly a lot more going on now. And, you know, the local council has been quite active in trying to encourage businesses to come to Tottenham, which has been great. And, you know, we've got some cracking breweries in Tottenham now, which is really good. You know, it's good for us.
Yeah, so there's... Maybe people overestimated what would happen, but there is now a bit like the Bermondsey area. Yeah. There's a couple of breweries around here. Is there a new community forming between those breweries now?
I think it's still a bit difficult for that, because in the early days these things happened partly just because there wasn't, you know, people were still learning the ropes.
You had to borrow malt and
trolley
or something. Yeah,
the breweries have become much more. Kind of much larger, much more professional now, if you like. So probably there's less of that. I mean, when we were up here, when Beavertown were coming up, you know, they gave me a call just to ask about kind of Tottenham and licensing, for example. And likewise, when Pressure Drop were coming up here, you know, they kind of popped up because they were looking at a couple of units around our, you know, further up north where we were as well. And then One Mile End are in our old unit as well. You know,
with your old kit as well?
With our old kit, and they brought in quite a bit of new kit as well. But our old brewer, Simon, who's left them now, but he moved in there with them. And then Bohem Brewery are just around the corner as well. So I remember, funnily enough, I did a piece interview with Will Hawks years ago, and we were the only brewery in Tottenham. And I kind of half jokingly said, "Oh, you know what? Tottenham's a really good area for a brewery. I mean, you probably, you know, give it a few years, you might see a bit of a beer mile in Tottenham." And I remember him kind of laughing that off. That of course now we've got a lot more breweries. But part of the reason is space. Industrial space. In Tottenham, there is still quite a bit of industrial space. I mean, particularly where we are, you know, it is the industrial part of Tottenham. And what areas like Hackney have been losing is that industrial space. And actually, it's incredibly difficult to find industrial space now in London. The arches have become very expensive. And to find affordable industrial space where there's good transport networks, good transport communications, it's really, really difficult. And I think one of the things that Tottenham has offered and why breweries have come up is there's been the availability of larger spaces. And also, it's still fairly central, slightly further out, but you get the benefit of kind of reduced rents because of that as well. So that has been one of the reasons why I think you've had people moving out to Tottenham. And now Tottenham's, again, getting more difficult to find industrial space in Tottenham. So, you know, whether people start now moving out to places like Enfield, Red Church moved out to Harlow, for example, and you've heard some of the breweries down in Bermondsey Beer Mile talk about having a larger site, you know, kind of further south where they do a lot of their brewing, but maybe keeping their tap room on site. And that's been part of the reason I think Tottenham has benefited from a number of breweries coming in. But these things almost kind of kill themselves off, because as you get more coming in, there's less space, rents start to go up, and then people look to find a new space.
So are you, I mean, you've always been very close to White Hart Lane.
Yeah.
Are you? How are you going to deal with the fact that there will be every other week 80 to 90,000 people coming to the area, and you're in the shadows almost of the new brewery?
It's
moments away.
Well, we opened when Spurs were at home last time, before they left for Wembley. We did open the tap room on a few occasions. It was fairly basic. So we got a fairly loyal group of people coming, and we know people are quite keen to come to the brewery. Well, you know, we're kind of with the crowdfunding campaign, we kind of offer discounts, and we know there's been quite a few Spurs fans who kind of signed up to that to get discounts in the tap room. So
it's,
I think,
like an addition to your season ticket
Well, exactly, yeah. And because it's only a 10-minute walk up the road, then it is ideal, really, for Spurs fans and actually away fans who are maybe coming wanting a bit of a day out. You know, they can come, have a couple of beers, do something a little bit different, and go to a space which is probably quite friendly, not quite as rammed as some of the local pubs, and then kind of walk 10 minutes around the corner to the ground. So our plans at the moment, again, because of where we are, we wouldn't get the kind of footfall that likes a Beavertown or Pressure Drop would get on a non-Spurs day, you know. So for us, really, the tap room only makes sense currently when Spurs are at home. And then we can get, you know, a good crowd in, and it can be a nice atmosphere. And again, you know, with Cascale, you want to sell it quite quickly, so you want to get a number of people in. Otherwise, you'll be, if the fans aren't due back for another 2 weeks, well, a lot of that beer will probably be getting chucked if we don't sell it.
Or the staff have
have to drink it. Yeah.
Take their time over cashing up. Yeah. And you mentioned local pubs. As a result of that regeneration that's happening, have you seen more pubs open? Are you starting to really nail home that local angle that we mentioned at the start?
So there's a pub called the Antwerp Arms in Tottenham who we were kind of involved with in that. The pub used to be an Enterprise Inns pub, and it got Enterprise Inns wanted to sell it. They sold it to a property developer, and it was going to get turned into house and flats. The community got together to save the pub, and they did a kind of a share raising exercise as a cooperative to buy the pub. And they got an asset of community value status listed on the pub as well. So we were part of that, and our beers are kind of proudly sold in the Antwerp Arms now. But we've also had places like the Beehive open, and recently the Blue Coats. And then there's been the High Cross, which is just up by the old public toilets in Tottenham, which has been turned into a lovely kind of pub and cafe. So there's a lot more places now that are doing good beer in Tottenham, and new pubs that have opened, restaurants that have opened. That really, it's very different from when we first came in, and we sold virtually nothing. We just sold beer to, I think there was a local kind of working man's club that bought some cask ale from us, and that was it in Tottenham. And now, you know, we sell a lot more to, you know, those pubs, particularly on a match day where Hotspur sells quite well because a lot of the fans like to drink that.
Yep. And have you seen, where does most of your beer go now? Where's your core markets? Is it London locals?
Still within the M25, so in particular North and East London. So most of our sales, North and East London. We do a little bit of distribution up to Manchester and Scotland and the North East as well.
So some Cascale heartlands further up north as well.
Yeah, we do some swaps with people like Acorn Brewery, for example, where we send some of our beer up to them, they send some of their beer down to us. And then we do a little bit of export to Italy and Denmark. And recently we've started sending some cask and key keg out to Russia, for example. So that's a kind of interesting one.
Cask and key keg to Russia?
Yeah.
And what accounts, is that a wholesaler who wanted it, or is that some accounts that got in touch?
It's a wholesaler that sells. They sell Ilkley and ourselves. And I think they might deal with Fuller's as well. So there's, a growing kind of market in
I am endlessly amazed by the interest in cask beer in the UK. Like in America, it's seen as like the ultimate hipster thing to do. Yeah. Whereas we see it as the ultimate socks and sandals grandpa thing to do. Yeah. And obviously somewhere in the middle is the reality. But to see Yeah, some people in Russia going, we want your cask beer.
Yeah, yeah. And in Italy, it goes down really well, too. I mean, we did a festival. There's a great beer festival called the Villaggio International Beer Festival in Tuscany. And we went out there with our Italian distributor, and we've been out there twice now. And we send pretty much all cask out to Italy as well. There's quite a good cask market in Rome. And this is a beautiful Tuscan kind of old monastery, I believe. And they have a number of Belgian breweries and some other European breweries and Italian breweries there. It's a great festival. It's really worth doing. And we... our beer sold out first, you know. We kind of sold six cask beers in this. It was in September, in Italy, the Tuscan heat, and the beers went down great, and they sold.
So you really sat there well. Nervous about the heat, and it actually.
Yeah, well, we had the hand pools and everything, so it went down really, really well. But as you say, it just goes to show there's quite often a real interest in cask in the other countries, partly because it can be something that's a bit different. And sometimes people quite like the slight different kind of subtle taste that cask has, whereas it's maybe not kind of so quite heavy on the in terms of the gas, the flavor profile. Sometimes there's a bit more body in it. And maybe the yeast plays a slightly more important role in some of these beers as well.
And the logistics of exporting cask. If it's in a key keg, I guess that's one thing, but I guess it has to be cold stored and...
Yep, yeah, so...
Is there anything to try and keep it as still as possible, or...?
No, I guess it'll... I mean, it will... It's the findings, if you've got... If you can just... The findings usually have about a kind of an eight-week... date when they arrive with us, really. So usually we'll get through those findings in good time. You obviously don't want the beer moving too often. Someone once told me, like, cask beer, you want to kind of move it ideally 3 to 4 times after you put the findings in. The first time when it leaves the pub, the first time when you fill it, roll it, second time, get it on the van, it gets moved, and then third time, goes into the pub, and just before the landlord puts it on, you give it a... And that will allow the beer to fine best. Yeah. But again, never really had much of a problem with our beers in Italy. Our beers, you know, we use conditioning tanks here as well, and so that can help to just ensure that we don't have too much. We certainly never have too much yeast in our beers, and so our kind of fining works quite well. And usually our beers can be fairly clear even without finings.
And a question I've always wanted to ask a cask brewer, and it's never come to me at the right time, is about bottles. So obviously the experience of drinking from a bottle, highly carbonated, different temperature, yep. But potentially, it's an incredibly different way to consume a beer than on cask. So when you come up with a recipe, are you aware of that? Or when you recommend how it's served, are you saying anything different to people?
Yes, I mean, at the moment we bottle a lot of our beers on site, and they're bottle conditioned, but we will prime them so that they will be fizzy, because that's what people generally want from a bottled beer. They want it colder, they want it fizzy. And again, I think you need to bear in mind the market your beer is going to. You know, it's one thing if you're in the pub, it's coming through a nice hand pool, you're sitting down, having a relaxing evening. You're sitting at home, it's a little bit different. You might want something that's colder, you might want something that's fizzier. You might want to take something out, and it might be, you know, during summer when, you know, our bottle sales probably sell better. Again, people want to drink, they want something colder and fizzier. And I think particularly in London, I mean, I know August can be our quietest month of the year, for example. And I know kind of traditional cask brewers, like people like Hawkshead, and, you know, kind of good friends with Surrey Hills Brewery, a cracking brewery down in Surrey. And they're incredibly busy during August, and partly because the pub landscape is different. Again, it's a lot of more traditional pubs with big beer gardens, and maybe drinkers that are maybe more slightly more conservative drinkers who are going out to the beer garden, having a nice pint of bitter, for example. Whereas in London, during the summer, there's maybe less kind of beer garden space, and so it's more likely people are going out to the pub, and it's hot, and they're wanting, and it's a younger demographic, and they're wanting something cold and fizzy. And I think one of the reasons we would like to do more keg and more kind of and introduce a can product and bottle product is partly, again, because those summer months are always our quieter months, and we need a kind of good balance of products to make that work better.
Yeah, it seems like an easy place to grow volume if you've got a dip. Yeah,
yeah. But you're right. We will need to kind of make sure we get those styles right, and we have a slightly, you know, slightly different product going into bottle and can than it's going into cask.
And so on a final note, where do you see the market of cask kind of going? Are we at peak numbers of breweries and now we need to double down on quality, or do you think there needs to be some new ideas injected into it by some newer people?
I think with cask, we probably are getting close to peak numbers of breweries. I think we've probably potentially got a more difficult economic landscape over the next couple of years, which will have its own impact on the brewing industry. I think one of the benefits cask has is it is seen as a kind of an affordable luxury almost, where people will go out and they're quite happy to, you know, spend £4.50 on a pint of cask beer. If you do get some kind of weakness in the economy and you do get some difficult economic times coming, it might be that people are less willing to spend, you know, kind of £6-7, for example, on a pint of keg. So there's that kind of aspect, I think, which might be a little bit kinder to cask, if you like, in the future. I think the focus always has to be quality, because that, as you said earlier, if you're not going to get a good pint of cask and you keep having the same problem in different pubs, you're just going to turn away from the style and you're going to move to a different, you know, you're going to move to, you know, a good solid quality keg beer that's, you know, not going to disappoint you. So I think that the market is still healthy for cask. I think we've probably had our rush to the bottom. I think it's, you know, I think cask has been as commoditized as it can be. I don't think there's going to be too much more pressure for cask prices to continue to fall. And I think pubs are, you know, always under pressure anyway. And hopefully for a lot of them, they can see cask as something a little bit different that isn't available in the supermarket, isn't available for people to drink at home, is something that they can really sell to drinkers. And that's not an easy thing to do. I think that's one of the things where maybe pubs can do a bit more, is really kind of say, right, okay, what can we do that's different? Well, cask is a very easy thing that a pub can do that's different to the supermarkets and other places. But I think we're probably going to have a period of stability in the cask market. Again, depending on what happens with the economic environment, there's going to be some challenges ahead.
Yeah.
And that's going to apply to all breweries. So focus has to be on quality. And again, I think always trying to, when I say delivering value, making sure you deliver the right quality of beer, the right style of beer that people are going to want to drink. You know, there's no point in us brewing a kind of a 12%, you know, imperial stout and trying to sell that to pubs, because it's probably going to struggle to work in the pub in a cask format. And we're not going to be able to get anywhere near the amount of money we need to.
Yeah, because I mean, beer, and I think in particular cask beer, is kind of habitual. You want people to have one and then say, "I'll have another," both on the night and, you know, week in, week out, which is what beers like Trinity are so brilliant at. So yeah, if we do have some financial struggles ahead, I'll probably be drinking some low ABV cask ale. So maybe the future is definitely rosy for cask either way.
I hope so.
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This is GBH's founder, Michael Kaiser. If you find value in the content that GBH produces, we'd love to hear it. Rate the podcast, tweet at us, send us an email, share it with a friend, whatever makes sense for you. That feedback goes a long way and helps others find us too. And if you're feeling generous, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion, and you should join. If you'd like to support GBH, visit goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true. Poor liberal folks. Have a great week.